Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Real View by Liam Hogan, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, read by Jean-Paul Garnier and Robin Rose Graves. On the fifth anniversary of the closure, we set up our feast in room 11. It's not just the subject matter on the walls that brings Emily and I back to this spot. One of the smaller rooms in the cavernous building, room 11's high glass ceiling lets down the light, making this octagonal space brighter than the more traditionally shaped rooms that stretch from it in four gloomy directions. Nothing is lit, because we're not supposed to be here. They closed down the National Gallery after they scanned every picture with RealView technology. RealView, as the manufacturers proudly boast, makes museums and art galleries obsolete, because anything on a RealView ultra-high-def 3D screen is indistinguishable from the real thing. The real thing doesn't let you swipe left. According to the official data, the speed record for viewing the entire collection, and not just those that were hanging on the walls when they locked the doors for the last time, is 3 minutes 42 seconds. That's under 4 minutes to view over 2,000 paintings. Viewing might be stretching the term somewhat. When you walk through, things take a little longer, and that's the way we like it. It's why we used to work here, back in the days when they needed guards to prevent occasional idiots doing daft things. Though Emily, who claims she's named after Emmeline Pankhurst, has a soft spot for suffragette Mary Richardson's knife attack on Vasquez. The Rockaby Venus is safe now. It doesn't need its bulletproof glass, doesn't need someone to stand guard. We do other jobs, better paid but soulless. Which is why, on this day of the year, we sneak back into the mothballed building, carrying a folding card table and as much food as we can. The guards' chairs are still here, so at least we don't have to bring those. Our clandestine feast takes inspiration from the paintings around us. The Four Elements by Joachim Berkelaar, each showing the bounty of the land, of sea, of air, ore, and this always seems a teeny bit of a stretch, the kitchens, meat being prepared for the ovens. The large paintings, though by no means the largest in the gallery, are packed with sumptuous detail. His feasts are more opulent than ours. We start with water, our fish course, smoked salmon on rye, a wedge of lemon, and a small peppermill helps bring it alive. A teeny pot of horseradish as well, though Emily declines. There are salmon steaks in Berkelaar's fish market, fat and pink. Perhaps the whole fish was too large to portray, though there are dozens of smaller kinds on offer. Not all of them are particularly attractive looking. There was no ice to display your market wares on back in the 16th century. Or perhaps Joachim took too long in their painting and was too faithful in his detail, though not entirely faithful. When you look closely at the paintings, something I doubt anyone online bothers to do, even though RealView lets you get as close as you like, close enough to see individual brush strokes or the weave of the canvas, you spot the little extras, the biblical backgrounds. I wonder if they were a condition of a commission or something to widen their appeal beyond the secular market. I can imagine these paintings hanging in the private chambers of a rich monastery, the abbot feasting and drinking, while silent novices in the refectory consume their gruel. No gruel for us, thankfully. I even brought a bottle of chilled Prosecco and the proper glasses in which to pour it. Emily asks if I'm trying to seduce her, and I have to think for a moment what the right answer should be. I used to have a thing for her, sure, but that was 5 years ago, and we both moved on, settled down with our significant others. I briefly consider using the line from The Graduate, but we both know that would mean yes. So I just grin and top her barely touched flute. She shakes her head at me, but grins back. We move on to the vegetarian course, Earth. Of the four, this painting is probably the most impressive and Emily's favorite. A cornucopia of produce, baskets overflowing with fruits and vegetables, squashes and carrots, and prize-winning cabbages. There's barely room for the teeny religious scene, hidden in the background, of the Holy Family crossing a bridge, Mary on a donkey, Joseph leading the way. Emily was a vegetarian when we first started work, though that stance has been softened by motherhood and time. She provided a smorgasbord of antipasto, grilled artichokes, an array of olives, those little red peppers stuffed with soft cheese, a French stick, broken in half for ease of carry, greedily soaks up the oil and vinegar. We begin our favorite game, the Judgment of the Judgment of Paris. There are half a dozen portrayals of this Greek legend on the gallery walls. So which one is our favorite, and which Venus actually deserves to win? When we started as guards, started the same day, went through the same induction, Emily was a spiky-haired wisp of a girl. Once again, time and motherhood have softened her. But she's still far better looking than all the Venuses and Junos and Minervas and all the judgments. Fashions change. Rubens' fleshy goddesses are not what we expect when we talk about beauty. I've changed as well, though the bathroom mirror is kind enough to show this as a gradual process. I've lost my youthful trim, gained some weight. There are gray hairs appearing at my temples and the beginning of lines on my forehead. I wonder if the tensions of work and home show in my face, and I have to assume that they do. Back to the game. I plump for an outsider. A judgment hidden away in a room even smaller than our dining room. By another Joachim. Joachim Utaval.
The one with the wedding in the background?
She asks.
Room 17, 17A?
And I realize there aren't any pictures on display that we haven't both seen. Haven't both guarded.
You old romantic, you.
She says, as I nod and probably blush.
A wedding on the eve of war.
We move on. Air, according to Berkelar's painting, is poultry. Poultry and rabbits. And cheeses and eggs. It's the second of Emily's courses. Coronation chicken and a pasta salad. As we eat, we play another game. Pick the most ugly child. They're mainly the baby Jesus, and the ugliest of them appear to have been painted by artists who have never actually seen a baby. Not a live one, anyway. There's a distinct blue tinge to the winner. There's certainly little to be adored, king or otherwise. It's a cue for Emily to pull out her phone and show me the latest pictures of her daughter. Not so young anymore. There's an awkward moment when she asks if me and Catherine... I shake my head. Time's not right, I say. Three words where 1,000 wouldn't be enough. It's on to the fourth and final course. Fire. Sometimes I wonder if we should save Earth until last. Bring in a strawberry cheesecake or maybe just a selection of fresh fruit. But after we pack up and leave, our load lightened, we usually stop for a final drink and a shared slice of cake at the cafe attached to the gallery, the only part still open to the public. It's a little bit of camouflage, a defense when we're asked where we were today, what we did. I unpack my secret weapon, a bulky thermos flask, and then second, a slimmer one, hot water for packets of dried and spiced couscous. Emily doesn't do red meat. She even prefers to sit with her back to the haunches being butchered in Berkelar's painting. So the thermos contains another poultry dish, a rich tangine of chicken and chickpeas and vegetables. After all we've already consumed, it sits heavy and isn't quite as amazing as I thought it was last night when I prepared it. But Emily praises it anyway, as I pour the last of the fizzy wine into my empty glass. We have a choice on our way out, depending on which of the four archways we choose to exit via. But as Emily tugs my arm, I know that this game has already been decided, already has its winner. Sunflowers? I ask, without having to.
Sunflowers.
She echoes. Even in the gloom, the bright yellow stands out. We hold our phones aloft in torch mode and stand a long while soaking it in. When we emerge via the discreet little side exit and step into Trafalgar Square, the day's brightness is dazzling. A crocodile of tourists winds its way past, eyes fixed on their screens, earpieces relaying their guide's monotone narration. Perhaps they are real viewing the gallery's most iconic pictures, Van Gogh's included, as they walk. I nod in the direction of the cafe, but Emily shakes her head.
Better not. Best get back.
Never mind, I say, hiding my disappointment. Next year, perhaps? She frowns.
You weren't really listening, were you? My 15-minute rant on the state of inner London schools, how we thought about moving to the burbs, but after Mike's father passed away, well, like I said, we'll probably be moving to...
Exeter? To live with Mum? I complete for her, just to prove I was listening. And I was. I just hadn't worked through the ramifications. Doesn't mean you won't be back.
Actually, it probably does. Sorry, and... And there's another reason. Another child on the way.
Ah, that explains why I ended up drinking all of the fizz. Did I miss that announcement as well?
No.
She laughs.
No announcement. Not yet. In fact, you're the first to know.
After Mike? I correct.
Including Mike.
She shrugs.
We've had a few mishaps along the way. So no telling. Not yet, okay?
Mum's the word, I quip. And congratulations. After she's gone, after we've hugged and she's kissed me on the cheek, I sit on the edge of one of the two fountains. Over on the steps, there's a noisy protest, a passionate campaign to bring back some online recipe archive or another. Taking out my phone, I clip the 3D viewer over the lenses of my glasses and thumb through the pictures until I find the one I'm looking for. It's not Van Gogh's sunflowers, or any of the other artworks sitting forgotten and forlorn on the gallery walls. It's a real view of Emily. One of the final jobs we were given was to assist with the scanning process that made us redundant. She looks embarrassed to be pushed in front of the three-eyed, monstrous device, arms crossed in defiance. And there's a tilt of her head, a wry smile as if, I sometimes imagine, she's wondering if I had another question in mind when, on our last day of working together, I asked if I could take her picture. A moment frozen in time. Something lost, even as it was being preserved. I close my eyes, still seeing her. Seeing her older as well. Her hair grown out, the color softer. Sitting across the little card table I wonder if we'll ever use again. My thumb hovers over the delete button. Indistinguishable from the real thing? Not even close. Psionic Thread by Sam Fletcher, with music by Fog Machine, read by Jean-Paul Garnier. The agent knocked politely on the loft door.
"Come in,"
Mr. O'Kane said before clearing his throat. His voice was weak. He entered wearing a tailored black suit and no tie, taking special notice of the room, as most do who see it. Large canvases lined the walls. Brushes, half-squeezed tubes, rags, and other paint-stained odds littered the hardwood. To most, this was a place of legend.
"You must be Mr....
Mr. O'Kane's words trailed off in thought from the bed across. There were many names he couldn't recall these days. The agent didn't seem bothered. He walked over, set his large metallic case on the floor beside it, then leaned against the frame. "My friends call me Az." Mr. O'Kane coughed, slow, heaving ones that involved his entire upper body.
"Is that what we are?"
he asked. "I consider all who I meet in this way to be friends," Az said. He continued to look around the vibrant paintings. "This is quite the hospital room." Mr. O'Kane almost smiled.
"I'm too old for treatment, they told me. If I'm going to be in a bed, in a room, I decided it should be like this one here."
He looked out the window as he spoke, high above the city, to the ocean. Az joined his gaze. "I take it you know why I'm here?" he asked. Mr. O'Kane nodded, meeting his eyes.
"To assess my memories."
"I want to make sure your transition is a peaceful one," Az said. "Do you have any questions for me?" Mr. O'Kane hardly paused to think.
"Less about my own memories and more about those who will live on,"
he said.
"Which of my works were most influential? How will I be remembered? What will stand out? My large-scale commissions? My abstract exhibits? My murals?"
The agent stayed locked into his eyes. "You seem to focus only on your work from ages 28 to 79. Why is that, sir?"
"What do you mean?"
"Even members of the bionic generation tend to desire revisiting their most prominent memories. As if forgetting theirs was the first to have their entire neural activity preserved from birth. Threads do more than eliminate brain injury and mental disorders."
"I'm not following."
"What I mean is, I'm beginning to have the rare opportunity to speak with my clients about their whole life, without the smallest of gaps. Would you like to see your entire oeuvre?" Mr. O'Kane didn't at first respond. Just watched the agent unclip the hinges of his case and lift out two VR headsets from their foam holders. Az handed the old man his set, helped him fix on the sleek helmet. And the room went black. One by one, paintings ignited in light, hung on an invisible wall in this void. The gallery seemed to stretch on forever. Mr. O'Kane hobbled out of bed over to the square in front. An endless sea of clouds, white ribbon and rainbows, sunbeams fringing every line with gold. "What do you see?" Az's voice startled him here. The agent appeared with large, dark feathered wings protruding from the back of his suit.
"It's heaven,"
Mr. O'Kane said. He looked deep into the painting as if for the first time.
"I remember this one well. One of my first professional rated sales. A woman at the gallery told me she felt God in this piece. I won't accredit anything to this one, but it was a major shift for me. It was the start..."
His words choked.
"The start of me discovering my muse."
"Your muse?"
"I felt it too as I created it,"
said Mr. O'Kane.
"God. I started chasing that feeling, my purpose. The more I painted, the thinner the wall became between me and the other side. from me to him.
As followed Mr. O'Kane along the line of paintings, they passed abstract displays of color, detailed biblical scenes, vast landscapes blending spiritual perception and photographic precision.
Before that piece, I was starving for recognition. The more I painted, the closer I came to him, the fuller I felt. Pay and respect fell second now. The only thing left truly was...
Mr. O'Kane stopped at the illuminated piece, the tunnel to the other side. A bright beam at the end of a hallway. A centralized, divine figure in the middle of it. He had no face, no body, just a stature. Just a presence drowned in light.
God.
Why did you not show what he looks like? Az asked him. Mr. O'Kane turned to the agent.
God is a feeling as much as a being. If mystery fades, so does passion, right?
When Az didn't respond, Mr. O'Kane continued.
But these, my shifts of inspiration, from being hungry to when my pieces became recognized for shamanic qualities, to when I truly, undeniably found my muse. Which will live on the longest?
I cannot speak to any collective memory, Az said. But from my perception, those are not the influential shifts I would mark. Mr. O'Kane crinkled his thick brow. Az held up two fingers and touched the glowing squares in front of them. Then he swiped. In swift motion, the line of paintings scrolled past. When the blur settled, they were at the beginning, the first painting. It was white, with a simple gray line in the center.
What is this?
Mr. O'Kane asked him. Your first work of art, Mr. O'Kane, he said. A pencil dash on a scrap paper. There was a time before your hunger, you know. See, you didn't even bother to sign this one. The two walked along the line of paintings as Az continued. By age 3, you began to experiment with colors, your most common tool being the crayon. Age 4, you experimented then with canvas, skipping paper and easel and moving straight to drywall. This, of course, was wiped from history by your mother and never restored. They kept walking. Age 5, you gained the ability to color inside the lines. In this case, a coloring page from an Italian restaurant called Diana's.
Why are you showing me this?
Mr. O'Kane asked. To display your true eras, those not defined by attention, not by money, not by God.
What then?
Walking still. Before age 10, art and play for you were synonymous. Age 10, I would argue, started your first shift. This is when these doodles of yours decidedly bled into your identity. This was the first semblance of your commitment and passion to the form. It lasted through your teenage years until you studied art formally as an undergraduate. Here you became educated in ways different from high school pursuits. This, I would argue, was your second shift. Perhaps it is the one that you call your hungry years. Your next shift wouldn't come for years down the road, after you sold your first couple of pieces at a professional rate. This next shift, for me, embodies both of those that you call your shamanic and muse faces. I call it ego. In your 30s, painting was a competition. You were now a voice in a chorus of peers, destined to be heard, craving critiques. You had to be better, but more so, you had to be different. You found your lane, a spiritual purpose in your work. Finally, with this phase, you found peace. But you must understand, Mr. O'Kane, God didn't give this to you. It was there in the beginning, on printed paper, on the drywall by your childhood staircase, on the coloring page at Deanna's. It was within you. Nearing the end of the line, Mr. O'Kane paused before a brilliant square.
I've never seen it like this before.
Ah, yes. Your most prominent international work. The Vault of Marseille, Notre-Ange. It brought many who stood before it to tears.
My magnum opus,
said Mr. O'Kane.
The one that could make atheists believe.
It was nothing, as said. Based on my analysis of your trajectory, your likelihood of such opportunities paired with your evolving interest and style, you would have had more prominent and respected work within 3 years if the tumor hadn't formed in your lungs. Mr. O'Kane's pupils fell to the floor and swayed left and right.
What are you saying?
He asked.
That my work has no divinity at all? No essence? It would just keep changing forever?
From what our studies tell us, each and every experience changes the consciousness and personality of the experiencer by varying degrees. Thus, if we were not interrupted by death, if we lived long enough, our personalities would eventually become so estranged from our initial consciousness that we would be fully unrecognizable.
Then what was telling me to paint all those years? What was it pulling me closer and closer in?
Do you remember the story of Moses and the burning bush?
Of course,
said Mr. O'Kane.
Exodus 3:13. God told Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt.
Yes. Well, Moses asked God what name to tell the Israeli children of who sent him. And God responds, I am that I am. Moses is to tell the children that I sent me unto you. Mr. O'Kane's face fell as he considered these words. If my tenure at Psionic Thread has taught me anything, it's that the only thing that we can know exist for certain is our minds. Everything else, as gestured to their virtual surroundings, can be fabricated. That means Descartes, and all those centuries ago, in saying, I think, therefore I am, was right. And doesn't that sound remarkably similar to the words of your muse? Mr. O'Kane thought about this for a while, as broke the silence. Only two things are self-proving, Mr. O'Kane, gods and minds. And no one challenges the existence of the mind. The old man finally looked up again.
God is reference to self? Self is some ever-changing glob of nothing? You mean to tell me that there is no soul?
Az took a step back from the man and pulled all the glowing paintings together. They mixed and expanded, growing brighter and brighter. Then he spoke. There was no soul, Mr. O'Kane, but there is now, through preserved consciousness. Mr. O'Kane's life's work swirled in front of them into a massive ball of light. No, an entryway. In the center, a figure formed. He had no face, no body, just stature. Just a presence drowned in light. Would you like to meet yours? It was blinding. Mr. O'Kane squinting until it stung. Then ripped his headset off and threw it on the hardwood. Breath heavy, he looked again at the dim sunlight filtering into the loft. He looked again at the ocean.
No,
he said.
I wouldn't.
In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Real View by Liam Hogan, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, and Psionic Thread by Sam Fletcher, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Come visit us at our bookstore in Joshua Tree or online at spacecowboybooks.com. Don't forget to subscribe and visit us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the show.